They knew this day would come.
Want you back here in one piece?
They thought they would be prepared for it.
They are coming right at us.
Try to shake us loose.
They were wrong.
There are at least 50 Dominion ships headed our way.
Right now, there's no way we can beat the Dominion.
Weapons ready.
The wormhole's opening. The Dominion. They're coming.
God help us all.
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between the Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton hunting for Saber Bear on Kang's Summit.
Classic Tyler.
I know.
And we have a very special guest this week, crawling victorious out of internment camp 371, Patrick Johnston.
Do they have drinks, food, and sex in this saloon?
Well, that's unclear, but I have to know first, Patrick, are you a Vorta sex maniac?
No, I don't think they are, by the way.
No?
No.
Being clones and all, I guess
being
there's
clones,
no
yeah.
primal urge for yeah. sex. Cam, on that digression, what exactly
no,
are we talking
let's
about?
Let's follow this path week. And see where it winds up. This week, we are going to talk about the Deep Space Nine two-parter In Purgatory's Shadow and By Inferno's Light. We are at the point where these titles are beginning to get confusing and unwieldy, and just mentioning two of them in one sentence becomes a bit much. But, yeah. Tyler, you know, this is a two-parter that I think is pretty well known in canon. You know, it's the episode where...
Broad summary. Yeah. Essentially, Garak gets a message from the Gamma Quadrant. He heads over there with Worf, and they get captured, and they're stuck on this asteroid. Meanwhile, the Dominion is building up its fleet in the Gamma Quadrant. By the time everything is said and done, Dekat announces that Cardassia is part of the Dominion. So that's kind of the summary right there. Wow, what a fun kind of mythology-heavy episode here. Patrick... your first memories of this one.
It was incredible. It launches everything that you kind of think of being sort of the second half of DS9, I guess. Starts here.
It's been building up for a while.
It's amazing. And I mean, you didn't tell me what it was going to be. And we sat down, we started watching it. A couple of things kind of, even in that long, long intro, which is amazing how long it goes on for. I sort of said, is this? Wait. And then I can't remember what it was, but there was something, and then I sort of turned to you, like, well, I know what this is
yeah.
now. And I was very excited. No,
nice.
It was, and I mean, I even made the joke when we were watching, you know, waited between the two episodes that, like, when this was first out, you're like, what's going to happen? Like, this is awesome.
Oh, it ended on a cliffhanger.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Mid-season, amazing cliffhanger, and you had to sit there for a whole week wondering what was going to happen.
I love that. I don't like binging television personally, but Cam, what was your memory? Because you did actually binge Deep Space Nine. You were not one of those week-to-week watchers back in the 90s.
Right. As we've gone through these two-parters, whenever I'm assigned, you know, titles to revisit, I'm like, I have no memory of what episode that is based on the titles. But as soon as I sat down to watch this one, I was like, oh, I know this one really well. What was interesting was I did not remember it as a two-parter.
Really?
No.
Okay.
That was the interesting part to me. I was like, oh, I know this story really well. Oh, it was a two-parter? I did not remember that, but I remembered loving it the first time around, and I'm excited to talk about more about it.
I viewed it for the first time, and this pains me to say it, but I missed it first run. I had to catch up during summer reruns, and so I actually saw the season 5 finale before this, and there was so much build-up, and I was actually just piecing together kind of the story that had happened as I watched more episodes throughout the season. So I also had to read like synopses from online. So my experience was a little tainted, but man, this is
tained.
Such a... tained, yes. Thank you. Of course, Enbrin Tain plays prominently in this episode here. Guys, why don't we just dive into it? Let's start off with part one here. In Purgatory Shadow, I think that's the name of it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm gonna get the two episode titles mixed up at least four more times.
Really friendly, you know, the Inferno, which of course in Dante's version is the first part,
of
comes
course.
Before Purgatory, which I mean, we'll come back to that. I think that's also a fascinating aspect of it. I was sitting there trying to kind of piece all that together. But yes, Inferno comes after Purgatory in Deep Space Nine, apparently.
Well, you know what? Armageddon's going to have to wait for another day, Patrick. So just, you know, hold your horses there.
They're
well
canceling the apocalypse.
Yeah. But guys, jumping into it, I always enter into these two-parters and I ask myself, what is this about? Who is it about? And I'm just constantly amazed that Garrick gets to have two-part episodes dedicated to him.
I know. We already covered The Die Is Cast and Improbable Cause, which was such a strong two-parter.
Yeah.
I did not, again, remember, man, this is way more Garrick heavy than I remember. I mean, I remembered him being obviously a very crucial part of it,
yeah.
But not as much of it being like a real character two-parter for Garrick.
Who doesn't love a spy? Come on.
Oh, that's very true.
Torreziel sure does. That's for sure. Because look, episode starts off, we see Garrick and Bashir and Torreziel. They're all munching on food together in the REPL mats. And we start to realize that Torra's thoughts about one Elam Garrick. And when Dekat discovers that he's not really having it, what would you do? Patrick, you're going to be a father in a few months. Mm-hmm. What would you do if your future son or daughter was going out with a dude like Garrick?
Wait, are you comparing me to Gul Dukat?
Yeah.
Wow.
There's so many more comparisons I can make right now. don't let the listeners
listen. The fury in my eyes, the paranoia.
Mm-hmm. The egomania.
He does have swagger, though.
He had tons of swagger. Yeah. This is a great Dukat episode. I really enjoyed just about everything he did today.
Is he not the most egomaniacal kind of character in all of Star Trek, though?
Absolutely. And the thing I found myself thinking about was how this... I mean, there was a line, what does he say about your silly superstitions? And you're like, okay.
Yeah, yeah, referring to the Bajoran religion.
And you're like,
yeah.
Well, this is interesting. That's an interesting beginning point, given where you end up. But no, I found myself...
I never even thought about that. Yeah, with the Paul Wraith cult leader.
Yeah, and you know...
I don't think they'd figured that part out yet.
Well, that's what I found myself wondering. I'm like, have these guys sat back and say, okay, this is the middle of the fifth season. We have, you know, hopefully 2.5 years left. We have a big story to tell. Let's start it here. I would love to find out. Did they even have that in the back of their mind? Because I found myself thinking that right off the top.
I feel like they maybe had some of Dukat's arc broadly sketched out, but I feel like they did not have season 7 sketched out at all.
No, but you know what? I think Cam and I, we've discussed this. After the Dominion invasion arc, Dukat just kind of wandered around. They didn't really know what to do with that character. So I don't know if they had really figured out where this guy was going, other than he was going to be leader of Cardassia, at least for the, or at least the puppet leader for at least a few episodes.
And, a guy who, he's sort of a Petain type character. Like, he thinks he's doing the best for his...
The Marshal.
The Marshal, right? Yeah. And, I mean, I'm kind of amazed he doesn't make himself a legate right off the top. But anyway.
You know, that's actually brought up in a future episode, though. And they're like, I'm surprised you didn't call yourself Legate. He's like, I don't like the sound of it. It's like, wow, okay.
Well, Legate Dukat doesn't roll off the tongue quite
It's very true.
Yeah.
But like, Mark Alaimo in this role is so charismatic. I mean, he just walks in. This two-parter is an embarrassment of riches in terms of characters we love to see explored. And just throwing Dukat into the mix, it's just like, how much better could it get? I was writing down on my notes, like, this is a two-parter essentially starring Martok, Garrick, and Worf. Like, three of the most badass characters in Deep Space Nine, if not the most badass. And then Bashir, you know, but... But still, this is a two-parter starring those four characters. Like, what a strange combination. You know, we look at the TNG two-parters. They usually center around the most popular characters, like your Picards or your Datas. You know, we're at a point where it's like they're heavily involving secondary characters as the primary, you know, engines of the two-parter.
Yeah. Guys, maybe we should talk about that Bashir bombshell that we got in the middle of the episode, where these guys, they're in the prison camp, and they bring in another prisoner, and it's revealed that Bashir's actually been replaced by a changeling back on the station. What did you make of it at the time, Patrick?
It was mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Both parts, because I think I was pretty into DS9 by this point, watching it the first time around. And so, you know, you were aware of Martok. He's a character that's been there. You're like, okay, that's, you know, that Mart. I mean, he didn't know what a major character he's going to become, but you're like, that's that guy.
He's familiar enough.
That's not good.
Right.
And then there's all this stuff going on, and you have no idea it was coming. I totally remember this. And all of a sudden, in walks Bashir. By the way, great. I love the continuity. He was only away for a month, but they still said, you know what? He still would have been in the old uniform.
Okay, yeah. But Patrick, that 1 month period,
they refit the whole Starfleet in these new uniforms that showed up in the movie. And I think actually because the movie was out like a month before because it was at Christmas, wasn't it?
So the movie was out in November, and this episode was in the new year. But the thing is, they would have been on like a hiatus. So right. I think only like 4 or 5 episodes had aired at that time. But
right.
Those are a busy 4 or 5 episodes with regards to what Bashir is up to. Changeling Bashir apparently delivered Kira Yoshi O'Brien.
Right.
He also performed brain surgery on Sisko.
This begs the question.
See, I'm glad you looked this up.
Did this changeling really study up on his, like...
Look, these changelings could be, what, like... millions of years old, for all I know. Maybe they've had time to study like humanoid physiology quite extensively.
And let's be honest, his assignment is rather huge. Like, you're going to make sure that this guy does not get caught because his job is to literally destroy a star system.
Yes.
Yeah. And like, according to Memory Alpha, they figure they had it roughly sketched out that Bashir disappears around the time of the episode Rapture. And so it's a few episodes before this, but yeah, it would be interesting. I want to go back because I'm doing a rewatch now. I'm just in season 3 of DS9, my, you know, episode to episode rewatch. And I'm going to pay attention to those episodes. I know that, you know, Sidig Alfadel had no clue that there was any sort of swap. So look, this was not something that I think was planned out.
I don't think he was happy about not knowing.
But I'm interested to just watch those episodes between Rapture to this one and just see if it feels really weird to know that it's a changeling.
Right.
To see if it really sticks out as being false.
No, but you know what? I think in the DS9 companion, they say, yeah, we didn't know at the time that.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's why I bring up things like brain surgery that he's performing on Sisko. But what did you think of Sidig Alfadel's performance as changing? Like, there's definitely he's playing it differently though, like the kind of yes, Patrick.
So I was actually, because I had forgotten it was this episode, and all of a sudden I'm like, wait a second, I know what's gonna happen here. And so I actually caught that early enough that there's an exchange with Bashir where you don't know he's been replaced yet,
mm-hmm.
where essentially he is arguing against the mission. Right. So there's the scene where he marches Garak upstairs and says, because he thinks Sisko's going to say no way.
Yeah.
And you're sort of going, that's kind of, and why does Garak go? But Garak's like, yeah, okay, I guess you're right. And he marches him. And he essentially, even in the meeting with Sisko, is arguing against the mission.
Yeah.
Basically saying, what are you doing? And I was just like, whoa, like we didn't. Well,
they're planting seeds.
Yeah, yeah. But the thing I thought about, I was already thinking about the bombshell, because I was like, we don't know that he's not a changeling. I mean, this is really good. And it was very sharp. And I didn't think it wasn't Bashir at all. Like, which is, you know, O'Brien's point later on was like, you were, you know, I got along better with you. But like, let's be honest. I mean, the things like, oh, hey, I ordered, you know, I ordered the new rackets. And he's like, what are you talking
about? Yeah, the darts.
Darts. Yeah. But I mean, in hindsight, that's kind of a Bashir thing, which is them still thinking, well, you know, he's grown up, but he's still kind of a youthful buffoon.
Sure.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I do love the old trope, though, that someone can be completely indistinguishable, but the second that the audience is told that they're an imposter, they suddenly start acting evil in every frame of the shot. It's amazing.
Well, I know Sidig Alfadel, he was not happy with kind of like the revelation that he was genetically enhanced. And
right.
He said that he kind of changed his performance every time that they brought that up. And you definitely see kind of the difference in the way he was portraying Bashir in these shots. And I think it goes beyond just kind of the directing, although there were some amazing shots when it came to like the directing of this episode and how Bashir's portrayed. Just that sandwich scene where he's like innocuously delivering sandwiches to Dax and O'Brien.
Yeah.
And it's just like the creepy music playing. It's like, oh, this is from like a horror film right now.
It's very Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah.
Are they going to figure it out?
No. No, they don't.
No, they're just happy to have sandwiches. They're really hungry.
They're really good sandwiches.
Their blood sugar level's really low at that point.
Like, why is the doctor making sandwiches? Like, does he have not anything more important to do?
What other doctor in the franchise of Star Trek would make sandwiches? I could picture McCoy maybe doing it. But
what about Phlox?
Phlox, okay, yeah. But I don't see Crusher or the EMH doing it, though.
Not a chance.
I think Catherine Pulaski makes sandwiches.
Does she?
Yeah,
you
think so? No, because she hates replicated stuff. She hates the transport.
Okay.
Right? But Data doesn't get a sandwich.
Data, what? Well, you don't eat.
Hey, speaking of food, I love the Earl Grey joke that Garrick made about the replicators inside the runabouts. Give me a good Earl Grey tea joke. And guys,
comic gold.
Was this not actually a pretty funny episode?
Well, I was going to say, the writing of the characters in part one was so strong. You have all these interesting pairings where you have, you know, Garrick and Worf on a ship just bantering. I mean, how often do we see that on the show? And what an interesting pair, because they're both kind of mercurial, both these loner sort of Ronin types.
Yeah.
And to see them just like bounce off each other and annoy one another was so much fun. But, you know, it's not just like that pairing. Obviously,
But let's bring up what they're like bantering about, though. Would you want, you know, say one Elam Garrick in Starfleet Academy as he proposed to Worf?
Make me a commander.
Yeah.
I've got lots of experience. Put that in the letter.
Yeah. Let them know that in your reference letter that you would love to serve under me.
FYI, Worf, I really am messing with you. No, absolutely. I love Dave Garrick. You know, he's perfect for Section 31. Come on.
Dang right.
You
got to
recruit him from somewhere.
Yeah. Would they ever take Garrick?
No, never.
Never.
Absolutely not.
The fact that they got Nog into it, it made me think, like, maybe they've lowered their standards after, like, telling Wesley he can't cut it.
Right.
But there's no way that Garrick could maybe be, like, some sort of, like, CI sort of dealio, which essentially he was when the Dominion War broke out.
Garrick he's too suspicious. He's a massive security risk.
Yeah.
He serves your purposes as a, you know, other guy, as they use him throughout the series, and that's his role. It's fantastic.
Yeah, but Cam, you're talking about the writing on this and like how great the characters are.
And you know, the episode opens with like a discussion between Kira and Odo about his like love life, and you know, there's these interesting scenes of or also Jadzia and Worf before Worf leaves on the mission. You know, and they're having
them fighting over Klingon opera. Isolinear rods.
And I was writing in my notes, like, the subtleties to the dialogue and the handling of Worf is so head and shoulders above the writing of TNG for that character.
Yeah.
Like, he feels like a three-dimensional character the way that Deep Space Nine writes him. And it's just, like, little just subtleties to the language. It just feels like there's more recognizable, you know, authentic behavior to him than what we would see in TNG, where it was like, you know, honor good and, you know, fighting good, and, you know, he was often, you know, like he'd be grouchy, or he'd be, you know, it'd be episodes driven by his honor.
Yeah.
Whereas
ethics, one of my favorite.
Of course, ethics, one of the greats, you know, but, you know, this episode, and, you know, I was writing down in my notes too, this feels like the show is hit like the fever pitch of, you know, right here to the end of where the show knows exactly what it is, how to write these characters at the top of their game, and just how to make these, you know, just plots that just suck you in.
They have found a way to finally make a plot-driven show because they understand the characters so well.
And I usually, I'm not a fan of kind of the episodes that are kind of plot-heavy, and this, I did my best to summarize the episode, but I mean, there's a lot. There's so much going on, but I was sucked into it. Like you said, Cam, you know, like I if there's enough great character stuff in, I'll just go with the plot. I'm not going to question it too much, even though I can nitpick this or that.
It doesn't even matter who the character is at this point, because all of the cast of Deep Space Nine is so strong that you could fill in any of these and build a two-part around them, and it would be interesting. You know, it's not like TNG, where maybe if it's like a Geordi two-parter, you're like, oh, this might not be so hot.
A Geordi two-parter.
We gotta give Deanna something to do.
yeah, exactly. You know, the show just feels like it's humming on all cylinders in a way that no Trek series has ever done before.
Okay. But why don't we talk a little bit about the return of one Martok here?
Because
I think he's worthy of a bit of a conversation.
Definitely.
Here.
Well, first of all, there is, you brought it up, the relationships, but there's, I had another R word, which is return. There's a lot of discussion of return, and I found it really interesting, especially early on when they're talking about the relationship stuff, whether it's Jadzia and Worf,
right?
Whether it's honestly Worf and Garrick, like all the pairings that you're getting on. It was actually, I was like, that's very interesting. And, you know, the idea, I'm going to come back, you know, Dukat actually comes back in the episode and then leaves, and there's this talk about him coming back, and we know. You know, I was thinking again when I was sort of saying, how much of the end did they actually have plotted out? You know, essentially the idea of Sisko, I mean, essentially being, he's not the chosen one, but the kind of the return, you know, the sort of return of the...
He's the emissary.
He's the emissary, but I mean, in the sense that the emissary comes home. Do you know what I mean? Like, emissary means you're sent away. You're representing something. And so I thought that was really interesting. And then, yeah, like you said, there's also this, like, Martok. There's the return of Gowron. I mean, the Gowron, sadly, stuff is so two-dimensional. But,
right.
But the return of Martok, which I thought was great, because, I mean, what a great character to bring into the series. And, you know, strong actor and just a well-thought-out character, but what he's supposed to be and what he represents and what his motivations are.
And we do realize that it's interesting that he lays out the timeline about his capture. He's been gone for 2 years, which means that he never actually met Worf for the first time in Way of the Warrior. That was a changeling Martok at the time. And I think it's fascinating to see how these guys can start their relationship where they do, where Martok's saying, and maybe we can dive into it a little bit more when we touch on part two, but Martok's is like, this is a man of honor. This is somebody that I respect from the ground up. And I like how that's kind of our starting point for what essentially is Martok Prime, you know, the first time right. We see like the non-changeling version of this character.
The more charismatic version.
I'd say so. Yeah. You know? I mean, like, honestly, like, the initial Martok was really a non-character. Like,
yes.
He had a couple lines here, but, like, I didn't think he was incredibly memorable. I'm just so happy that by the end of this two-parter, they're like, you know what? We know what J.G. Hertzler can do. Let's make him a permanent military commander aboard DS9 at this point.
Well, he was so impressive in his fight sequence that they were like, we got to sign that guy.
No one could flop like Martok.
J.G. Hertzler was just a fighting extraordinaire.
That fight, can I ask you guys a few questions about it? Like,
you may.
The having to touch like a light bulb. And so you don't yield. Are there not more practical ways of just, why not just say, hey, I yield? I don't quite get the light bulb thing. To me, I thought it was just kind of...
Well, if you're finding a brain can't say, hey, I yield.
That's a good point. But
yeah, language barriers.
I don't know. I thought the light bulb thing was kind of cheesy.
Multicultural,
I mean,
combat.
Tyler, you're not really, you know, you haven't done a lot of prison fighting like Patrick and I.
Okay. So. No, that is true. You got me there.
It's tough in the clink.
It's really, yeah, especially, you know.
Is that what they call it?
That is.
Hey, guys, I'm in the clink now.
So we were in a 1930s prison.
Yep.
A lot of dancing going on.
A lot of, a lot of bootleggers in there. You know?
Yeah, how come there was not a Klingon dance sequence during this, all the prison scenes? I'm very disappointed. Yeah, the prison stuff was great, though, because we actually do see Cardassians working with Klingons, working with Romulans, working with humans throughout this. Like, you can actually see that they do have some camaraderie going on after being in prison at least, like, 2 years. It took a while. I don't want to, like, you know, give it away just yet. We'll wait until part two. But even the Breen had something pretty cool going on.
Yeah, and I like that they populated the prison with different alien races and, you know, didn't feel compelled to have only a couple that they showcased as major characters. They were just there in the crowds. And I always like when the show does that and doesn't cheap out where it's like, well, there's like one Klingon, there's one Romulan, and then a bunch of normal-looking guys with maybe a bumpy forehead, maybe not.
Speaking of maybe the most prominent Cardassian prior to one Garak's arrival, though, is Enebrin Tain. And for a while, I was thinking, like, was kind of lame just to bring him back only to kill him off like this. And then, I mean, I'm so obtuse at times, though. And then we get the death scene where, like, he kind of finally acknowledges that, yes, Garak is my son. And the thing that I thought was best about this is he says to him, you were a weakness I could not afford. And if you're, like, the Cardassian spy master in charge of the Obsidian Order for 20 years... I actually believe him there. Like, I don't think he's just being a jerk, even though I don't think he's a particularly good father, but I believe his motivation for that particular decision.
It's a very pragmatic worldview and a cold one in many ways, because, you know, he says, I should have killed your mother. It's like, well, you know, that's a little dark, but, you know, I do like that there's, like, that one moment he remembers of Garak riding a Cardassian hound or something like that. I don't know what it was.
I think it's a Cardassian riding hound.
But he's saying, you know, he felt that moment of pride, and it's like, that is enough for him. Like, that relationship, that moment gave him something to kind of carry with him the rest of his life. And I think there's something to that that's kind of touching in the sense that these spies can't connect to anyone. So that's all he really has, but it means something to him. It was interesting, though, the revelation that he was his son. Did you know how this kind of came about?
Well, when a woman love each other, Cam.
No, this idea that Tain was Garak's father was pitched by a Star Trek author. Judy Klass, who wrote the novel, TOS novel, Cry of the Onlys, pitched the idea, and they liked the idea. They gave her $1,000 for the pitch. She didn't get a story credit, but they ended up using it based on that.
I personally, at the time,
it seems obvious, but well, she got $1,000 out of it.
Not bad, but you know what? Like, if we go back to Improbable Cause / The Die Is Cast, the thing that kind of I liked is that it wasn't necessarily just a mentor-mentee sort of relationship. Like, there was kind of hints that they were a little bit something more, and not necessarily father-son, but like perhaps like there's a like a more intimate relationship going there, and they're like, no, father and son. And yeah. I kind of like the ambiguity when it comes to a character like Garrick, especially with his sexuality. And then they kind of dull that a little bit when we have kind of this Torziel relationship that's kind of being sprung upon us.
Right.
All of a sudden, Garrick's not like this sexually ambiguous character that we kind of knew him as.
One of the things that I thought was interesting, I mean, overall, amazing performance by Andrew Robinson. Like, he's given so much to work with.
Yeah.
But early on, he talks basically about why he's going, and there's a sort of, he doesn't tell you it's his father, but there's an issue of sort of redemption there, which ties really well into the kind of the, if you look at the theme of the titles, where they're talking about Purgatory and they're talking about Inferno, because that's, you know, going in the order that Dante wrote it, and it's basically ascending to heaven, right?
So right.
It's man's redemption over the, you know, passing through the afterlife, and so essentially there is a theme here. Like I said, there's this idea of return, there's this idea of redemption, there's this idea of tying relationships, like who are you, what drives you, what comes before you and behind you,
right?
And that's what I liked about Garrick here, especially because you mentioned Improbable Cause, and I was sitting there thinking, wait a second, didn't we already know that Tane was his father? But we don't.
No.
But you're right. There's all these suggestions of it. And it's quite the moment. And I mean, it was interesting. There's a lot of moments in there too where City Galfadiel really, especially when he's on the prison camp, I thought his performance as well is fantastic, because he's this, you know, moments I find, especially in the second episode, we can talk about that, where the script kind of feels a bit rushed, maybe, or that they don't quite sell. I don't quite buy it, but you're like, okay, for the purpose of the story, there's certain sort of body language, I guess, that doesn't quite get it. But that scene that you were just talking about, where he's sitting there and he's just like, you know, this poor Garrick, you know, this guy that he respects. And then all of a sudden there's that moment and he's like, holy smokes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I
would you forgive your father for exiling you, Cam?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. He's done worse.
Okay.
No. What I really like about this two-parter, too, is that we get a lot of vulnerable Garrick moments. And that's something that I think fuels a lot of the really great dramatic moments on Deep Space Nine, is these moments we see Garrick broken down, because he's this character who's so mysterious, so aloof, so cold. And yet it's these moments where we see him kind of weakened for a second that make him so much more compelling.
So I think maybe that's a perfect way to segue into part two here. If you're talking about like Garrick in a weak spot here, he's dealing with his claustrophobia, which had been established before on the series. And I think it is fantastic watching this guy kind of in shambles, trying to essentially save everyone's life. He has to be the hero at this point.
Yeah. And this episode was inspired by The Great Escape. Originally it was supposed to be an Eddington episode.
Okay.
It was supposed to be Eddington breaking out of a prison, and the writers decided they didn't think audiences would be on Eddington's side. So they ended up shelving it, and it came back in this regard. But Garrick is cast in the, as they said, and he's the, from Death Wish.
Charles Bronson.
Yeah, the Charles Bronson role. Ooh, the guy who has to dig himself out of his claustrophobic. Yeah. Charles Bronson was claustrophobic in that, too. He's like, I've got to get back to Cardassia.
And the light. And the light.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Okay, so out of the prisoners we saw, who's the one who gets to ride on the motorcycle out of the prison?
Try to jump the fence?
Yeah.
It's probably Worf, right? Because he gets a big glory moment. Mm. In this case, it's a fight with the Jem'Hadar.
Yeah.
But
Worf is Steve McQueen.
Yeah, because, you know, Steve McQueen fails to jump the fence, right? Worf fails to beat that Jem'Hadar.
So, okay.
So Worf is the cooler king, the guy bouncing the baseball.
Got it, yeah.
Sorry, Sisko.
What which one's the Nazi?
Oh.
It's got to be the Vorta, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
then,
the Vorta, quite clearly from the beginning, are basically Nazis, aren't they? Like,
right.
They're the bad dudes, and they're in charge, and they're making the
Patrick,
calls.
Patrick, there are good people on both sides of the Dominion War, okay? I just want you to know that.
No, only the Jem'Hadar.
Right. Okay. Hey, what did you think about the Jem'Hadar's own sense of honor by the end of it?
I didn't really buy it.
No?
Did you?
I've always, I remember that, and I remember really liking it at the time, saying, yeah, these guys, I mean, I'm a huge Jem'Hadar guy.
Yeah.
I think they are just an absolutely fantastic creation, smartly created. Because they're sort of intentionally two-dimensional, and that's fine.
Yes, but every time you sprinkle in a little bit of nuance or give them three dimensions, I dig it. I bought it.
Oh, I do too.
Did you buy that this guy would essentially give up his life?
Yeah, I did.
Really?
Well, but did he know? Did he know that the Vorta would not necessarily?
He doesn't, because remember, he doesn't think that way, right? Like, he's programmed to do this, and he's like, this guy's amazing, and I want him on my side, essentially.
Right. The other argument is like, well, I don't need to kill him because we want to keep testing the Klingon for their fighting skills, so I'm done with him.
At the same time, he says, he's like, you know, I yield or whatever. I cannot, you know, I'm not interested in him anymore. And you're like, I'm pretty sure that's the end of you.
Yeah.
Bad choice.
Yeah.
But
don't forget, victory is life.
Victory is life.
Yeah. That's how Cam goes.
So he didn't win.
Yeah. Before. Like, he enters his work and he just shouts it out to all his coworkers.
That's what I shouted out in the clink all the time.
Yeah. Clink. Okay. Oh, I realize I do need to give some context to our opening salvo here on the podcast, Patrick. But Ziel's kind of like bummed out, and Quark's bumming her out when they realize the Dominion is going to be hitting into the Alpha Quadrant. And Quark's bummed out because he realizes that, you know, the Jem'Hadar, they don't eat, they don't drink, they don't have sex. Same with the Founders. And then she points out that maybe the Vorta are gluttonous alcoholic sex maniacs, which no other Star Trek series really talks about that, you know, our vices in such a way.
And the fact that essentially they're like, all right, we're just gonna own this. Like,
yeah.
Quark runs the brothel.
Let's just put
this on the table.
They've been hinting at it. I remember once in like season one, like Jake's like, hey Dad, I'm just going to the hall of suites, and he's like, you're doing what? Like, he was just like horrified. You know, it's a sex brothel, yes,
yeah.
As opposed to the other kind of brothels. And redundant munch, Tyler. Sorry.
And in an episode where Quark doesn't really have very much to do. I mean, him or Odo.
Odo. I was genuinely surprised by how little Odo had to do in a Dominion mythology episode,
especially after his opening with the suggestions of kinky changeling sex. The beginning.
Oh, yeah.
What do you make of that?
That whole, I was just like, what?
Is that a kind of an awkward?
What is going on here? And I'm like, okay, they're opening the door, and you know, you're thinking a bit about writing. Okay, they're kind of having a fun little thing. There's going to be a lot about relationships, and Odo just wants a relationship. And then where does Odo go?
Well, but it's also, okay. I'll say this.
Does Odo not know that Bashir is a changeling? Like, come on.
I never even thought about that.
He's a changeling again, remember?
But, you know, he's still kind of like an infant changeling, you know?
Not only that, but Odo's been separated from his people almost from birth. He may not be as cognizant of a changeling around him as say, the female changeling would be.
And I bet Bashir's taking steps to not give off any hints in front of him.
But there is also that scene, I can't remember when it is. Is it Way of the Warrior when he's like, Gowron's a changeling. Like, he thinks that...
Oh, okay, wait. That is the season 4 finale.
And he's like... And then they kind of drop it, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, this is the season 4 finale where he's in the Great Link, and then they give him images of Gowron
as... They plant stuff or something.
Yeah, they plant that. It's false images, and then they turn him solid.
Okay.
So, I wouldn't say it's quite the same thing, because he's within the Great Link at that point. And so Bashir had not been, say, compromised. So
no, but I mean in the sense that, like... Oh, right, because he's had the idea planted and Sorry for the confusion, listeners.
Yeah. But do you think it was a missed opportunity for Changeling Bashir and Odo not to share any scenes together?
What are you going to do with them?
It could have just been... I would have only been interested in looking at Changeling Bashir's reaction to Odo.
I mean, here's the thing. Odo already doesn't like Bashir.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty ongoing thing, isn't it?
I don't know that he doesn't like him.
He just doesn't
know
what's the
he's
point.
He's indifferent.
Yeah.
You fix people, don't you just fix yourself? I don't know. I mean, he's indifferent. Okay, fine. But, I mean, it's sort of, you know, there were some moments where they could have had it. There were some sort of staff meetings. Where is Odo? I don't know.
Yeah.
Does Odo get sent away?
No, he's bouncing around like
he's doing stuff.
He's deputizing Klingon soldiers.
Oh, that's right.
So,
He's chasing Vanos or something.
In part one, he's there in the teaser, and then in part two, he's not present, but he is mentioned multiple times on the station.
I would have liked one scene at least of him and the changeling Bashir.
Yeah.
Just one scene of them interacting in some way.
In some way, just because then there could be nuance there or stuff you wouldn't have thought about with when it comes to Bashir's reaction.
And it would have added some intrigue once you, if say they did it after you knew that Bashir's a changeling, and Odo kind of looks at him going, there's something off, but not sure, and then is investigating or something, and there's a, they ran out of time. Like, there's only so many threads they can pull in this one, but
Bashir looks like a pretty bad security chief if A, he's a changeling, and B, he can't detect changelings on his own station. One of them's on the senior
for
staff.
A month, or for a 2 month. Months. Sorry, 2 months, I think, wasn't it?
Or no, one month, about one month. Yeah.
Oh, right, 1 month, yeah.
Yeah, so.
It was, Martok was in there 2 years, and then, Bashir was 1 month, yeah.
Okay. Guys, I need to get it out there, though. Never turn your back on a Breen. Is that not just one of the coolest characters, just hanging out in that prison cell for an episode and a half, just chilling, not doing anything. Then at the right moment, he grabs a pistol.
The little lights in his visor. I love that stuff.
I loved it. But what a way to go out is like they simultaneously like disintegrate each other, the Breen soldier and the Jemadar as well. Like I've never seen that in Star Trek before.
You jumped at that moment. I saw it. There, actually jumped.
You not, jumped. Well, like, not in
you
fear.
Jumped at the first Romulan. No, you like, jumped at the Romulan getting disintegrated. You definitely did.
Oh, did it?
Like, oh.
Oh, okay.
What a horrible death.
I abhor violence, though. No, but you mean
you watching the wrong show.
You
there,
wept
fella.
For that, Breen.
But I jumped in like, hey, that's badass. Kind of jump?
I couldn't tell.
Okay.
All I saw was there was a very like obvious physical reaction.
I think I did a fist
moment.
Pump or something. Like, oh, yeah. Anyway.
Just speaking of the Breen, you know how they can't test to see if he's a changeling because he has no blood?
Yes.
I love that detail.
Yes.
Also, I thought of how proud would Admiral Layton be of all of them right in that moment, of cutting their hands, showing that they're actually real people.
That's very true, yeah.
And the throwaway line where Bashir goes, be negative if you're interested. I mean, but that's great script writing. I mean, that speaks again, especially to the first episode where they just kept throwing these little things in that just kept you going and showed the personality of these characters. Again, great stuff.
Why do you think this, 2-hour Star Trek prison drama was so much more effective than the other 2-part Star Trek prison drama, Birthright?
Oh,
because in that one we see Worf in a prison. You know, that one's overseen by Romulans. It's like the safe prison. And like, why does it just feel like this one? I wouldn't say there's like, ticking clock tension throughout, because in Birthright there's not, for sure. And I wouldn't say there really is in this one either. But to me, the conditions of the prison just feel scarier. It feels like I'm much more invested in the characters getting out than I was with Worf in Birthright.
Well, I think the investment is a key issue here. How many characters are you invested in that Birthright prison?
All of them, Tyler.
Yeah, yeah, like throwing spears through hoops. Sort of activity. Yeah, they play games in that Romulan prison in Birthright. Here, they fight to the death.
It's crisis. There's no crisis in Birthright. I mean, it's like, I think you all should leave.
Right.
Yeah. They're like, no, we like it here. We like,
Well, maybe some of us will leave and some of
that's
us won't.
That's the right. It's a bad, it's a poorly executed Klingon honor episode, whereas this is a very well executed Klingon honor episode. Although I kind of didn't like how they wrote their way around kind of saying, aren't you supposed to kill yourself if you get captured? Not if you can escape.
Right.
Like, really? It seems like an easy out.
Oh, come on. Yeah. Speaking of escapes, how is that runabout still sitting there? But
I wondered the same
maybe
thing.
We need to come, should we wait on that?
That was a little bit of a cheat. And then it was just conveniently left
how
up there.
How are we going to get them out of the prison? I don't know. What if we just leave the thing there by accident?
I would have liked to have seen a little more of the daily realities of this prison because, yes, the Klingons are going out to fight the Jem'Hadar. What is everyone else doing? Are they just like sitting around like doing nothing all day long?
That's essentially what they said.
Yeah.
Walking around.
We never saw like a toilet or anything.
How many people are, in this? They said what, number 6? Barracks 6? Isn't that what they said?
Yeah. And then there was that scene where they lined up all the prisoners.
Well, that's
and
true.
It looked as if there were maybe a 2 or 3 dozen and like half of them were Cardassians.
Yeah.
So you've got that. I did dig like little details. Like there's some real high ceilings when they first beam into the prison, and you get the feeling like yes, You're in the middle of outer space. Like this is an asteroid prison. I dig that kind of idea there.
Me too.
I really like that, and I thought they did a really nice... I mean, the fact they kept showing the asteroid with the bubble on it, I thought was great. Because you're like, wow, that really sucks. Like, there's no way out.
Guys, let's chat a little bit about Ducat in part two. Because I think there's some pretty fantastic stuff going on.
I just want to say, Ducat is like a Bond villain. It's like, even when you beat him, he calls you up and he's just like, well, good job, Sisko. I'll get you next time.
He's literally got like a Times Square big screen, like just like shooting messages to his followers.
He's a troll, man. He would totally be an internet troll.
I know. I love it. I mean, he's a horrible human being.
A human being.
Yeah, it's true.
Don't be alienist.
I did not listen to one Gorkon speech that carefully. What about his point though? Is he says to Sisko, "Why don't you guys just save a couple billion lives and surrender right now?" Is Ducat correct here? Like, if they had just surrendered, they would have saved billions of lives throughout this Dominion War.
Maybe.
Is freedom worth the sacrifice?
Well, the thing is, I think, you know, it's the convictions of the Federation versus the convictions of the Dominion. And to surrender those is to admit that the Dominion is superior.
Also, in the end, he's Pétain, and... I mean, I hate to say it, Sisko is—he's not Churchill, but he's you know, if you want an analogy, it's World War II,
right?
And they're like, no, we don't choose the alter. I mean, we recognize it's a painful choice, but we don't like the other choice, which is to sit down and who knows what happens.
But I just get the sense we don't know enough about the Dominion. Like, is the Dominion really that bad? We know that they want order and justice.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't sound so bad. We know that the Vorta are involved in resolving disputes, and the Jemadar are involved in enforcing the decrees. But the Founders are very much kind of hands off for the most part. They just want to be left alone.
Yes, but when you've got armies of stormtroopers running around, I tend to think that's probably not a great idea.
I don't know if we even got enough of a sense that the Dominion was evil, other than the fact that we're told, oh, they're authoritarian.
They're authoritarian and they have some really scary stormtroopers.
But to me, they've got. I'll give them, I was going to say it's more of a they tell, they don't show, but I guess they do show those scary ass
So once
soldiers.
Again, I need to call for my episode that's all about Star Trek politics.
Okay.
About the political system of the Jem'Hadar, of the Dominion.
Well, that's going to be like a 14-part episode of trying to...
Exploration.
That'll be a spinoff at some point.
We'll do that with our law episode that we've been debating to tackle for about, I think, 3 years, Cam. We've been kind of pushing
We've got a few topics we've kicked around for years. And it's like, one day they'll happen.
Most of it, you and I are just kind of obtuse and lazy. Yeah. And it's like, we don't want to have to think too hard.
Yeah, and then we end up going with something like Best Worst Episodes 3.
Yes.
You're just too busy hosting panels in Las Vegas.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we're in high demand.
Yeah.
So. There's only so much time.
But look, Ducat in this, like him trolling, I don't think there's any better troll in Star Trek.
Personally. No. And, you know, there's some great stuff with him and Xiao of him trying to convince her to come to Cardassia. And throughout the episode, I love that we just think he wants her back there for like personal pride. You know, it's like, look, you're my daughter. You got to come with me. Stop hanging around with this Garrick guy.
Yeah.
And then we find out through the twist that he's actually been negotiating with the Dominion this whole time. And now he's going to align Cardassia with the Dominion. That there's a reason he wants her out of Deep Space Nine.
Although he's willing to let the sun go supernova while she's on the station.
Well, she wouldn't go.
He is a psycho, we learned out later on.
He is a psycho, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but then she's okay with it. They have a good, strong relationship when he returns to Tarek Nor in the finale.
I think maybe it's just the case that he's such a deadbeat dad that what little bit you can hold on to, she's willing to take at times.
It's not the first time he was willing to let her die. In indiscretion, he tracked her down with the intention of killing her because she would have been like a stain on his honor as
well. Yeah, his searcher's moment, yeah.
I don't know.
He's not a stable person, though. I mean, that's the thing, right? I mean,
well, okay.
Everything is to advance himself.
Kira, absolutely. And
so,
Kira,
I mean, the fact he doesn't care about his daughter that he barely knows doesn't surprise me at all.
I buy it, though. But but this is what's interesting here, though, is Kira brings this up. She says, it doesn't matter to me. And she's talking to Xial about her father, Ducat. Kira's like, it doesn't matter to me what people think or what people say. but what they do. So just judge him on what he does here. And that's actually interesting because, Cam, do you remember during the DS9 panel, the Star Trek Las Vegas convention, Iris Stephen Bear and Mark Alamo were actually kind of getting into debate about this. You
right.
know, like Iris Stephen Bear is just like, I can't believe, you know, people think that Descartes is kind of a sympathetic character. He's like a total psychopath here,
right.
and it's based on what he does.
A sympathetic character.
Oh yeah,
really?
Including Mark.
Really,
Alimo. Yeah,
interesting.
Mark Alimo really like believes he is.
Well,
like
that makes sense to me. You know, the actor is always going to identify with the character, and isn't, you know, you're always going to play the villain as if he's a hero. And...
But how does he justify the red contact lenses that he's wearing by the end of this show?
I think he has to believe it. Like he has to believe that Ducat is in the right, because I think that's why he plays the character so well, is that he has complete conviction in what he believes.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. Like Ducat knows he's right.
Yes.
I mean, fair enough. I mean
Ducat is right, according to Ducat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, like, I have no problem. I mean, that's a very actorly thing to say, you know, that of course he's right because, you know, I am Ducat and I've inhabited, you know, his psyche and what have you. I mean, look, on paper, Ducat, no, he's not right.
Okay. You mentioned Gowron's return here. Robert O'Reilly, he loves rolling his R's at some point.
He's from the Scottish hillside of Klingon.
It seems that way, but I love his performance. He has to be one of the most distinct Klingons around, though.
Is there a more distinct?
The bug eyes, Patrick, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a more distinct Klingon?
Forgive. Well, oh, forget.
That was amazing, Patrick. I am impressed.
Gowron's my favorite guy all
time. Okay, look. So when we talk about distinct Klingons, I think, Gowron's got, like, an argument there. We got Martok with that, like, missing eyeball. And, like,
right.
Worf is Worf, you know. I think those are the big three. Like, I think those are the big three, even beyond any of the original series.
And
Klingons.
I would even actually argue Martok... It's only the eye. Like, take away the eye, he looks like
kind
a lot
like
of Klingons
Klingon.
You would see. So I would really say it's between Worf and Gowron.
Yeah. And I think Gowron was introduced in Next Gen versus... I think hardcore fans like you and me and Patrick might identify more with Martok, but I think the more casual fans would be like, oh yeah, I know Gowron.
Right.
He's badass.
Yeah.
Who's this Martok fella?
I mean, who's the one
Chancellor?
Who's the Klingon actor they hired for that board game? The video board game.
What's his Vige?
Experience Beige.
Oh, Experience Beige.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't choose J.G. Hursler.
Patrick, have you ever watched or played the VHS tape Star Trek Klingon board game?
I did once, but I didn't have the patience for it to actually sit there and watch the, you know, I had to fast, I don't even remember.
Really? Oh, man, Cam, you,
we
me
played
and,
it multiple times.
Benjamin Young, former or fallen co-host,
yeah,
played
it as
it multiple times.
Probably, you know, having some junk food with you and stuff like that. I mean, when you're
I got sugar high. Yeah,
yeah, right?
Totally. It's like that. But I don't
I like that game. It's a lot of fun.
And Robert O'Reilly liked it when you asked him about that game, too.
Yeah.
What did he say?
He's just like, oh, yes, yes. And then he went, Experience Beige.
Yeah, to hear him do that live.
That was
like,
pretty awesome.
One of my many dreams
so,
come true.
Sorry, which one of you has a VHS player?
It was actually Ben Young, a fallen co-host, bought the game, and I don't think it had the VHS tape with it, so he downloaded an actual, someone
oh,
had actually
okay.
put it on.
I think it was on YouTube, and then
something.
He like
and
scripted
he ripped
it off
yeah.
YouTube
okay.
and
all
put
right.
it on like
okay.
a flash drive, and we played it at my
I
old apartment.
I would have been weirdly impressed if one of you had a VHS player. Just,
I actually do have a VHS player.
Do you?
I do, yeah.
There's a whole other podcast.
Are you still weirdly impressed, Patrick?
No, I am. Okay. I am. It's absurd, but it's great.
But Gowron brings up a very good point here in that 5 years ago, no one would have heard of Bajor or Deep Space yeah. Nine. Look at us now. And I think that's such a almost kind of a mission statement about the series as a whole. Like, look at how important this is and look at the important people that are just intersecting throughout this space station's history, which I think it's so amazing, though.
Mm-hmm. And we see in this episode, too, that he rejoins, you know, he signs the Kittimer Accords again.
With his thumbprint. Which I
sure.
thought was incredibly lame.
Yeah. Do you think, because obviously they were broken in the Way of the Warrior, that, you know, they left the Kittimer Accords. And do you feel like that dramatic turn of leaving it and then coming back was paid off well? Or do you think it was kind of like, just get them back in it?
Yeah, I go with that latter.
Yeah, it didn't feel like a big momentous sort
which
of...
Which ties back to what I was going to say about this second episode, which is, again, it's interesting now given how we have... You know, all these scripted series, fascinating sort of era of television where they can just be like, nope, we're telling one story.
Right.
And this is still the era where you didn't do that. And it just be partly, you know, all kinds of reasons. And one of especially was that, well, you know, you kind of had to have people coming back each week. So, you know, rolling the dice on a like multi-episode arc was probably a bit of a risk.
Well, and look, Ira Steven Baer brought this up at the convention as well. But he said, like, back in those days, a dedicated fan would watch on average, I believe, one out of every three or four episodes. Right. And that's right. A dedicated fan. Right. So, yeah, to have, and look, I even missed this two-parter when it initially aired. Like, I had to catch up on reruns, too. Like, I was guilty of that. It's just kind of a different era of television.
Yeah, like, you would miss an episode just because the VCR didn't tape properly, or you were out and you couldn't make it home on time.
I would have, like, basketball practice. Yeah. Not that I ever played basketball, but...
I was in the clink.
You're in the clink.
Cam, that's why Cam missed the entire first run of Deep Space Nine. Juvenile offender.
He spent the entire time with a tin cup that he was wrapping against the bars. It was pretty painful to listen
anyway,
to.
Anyway, I was going to... I mean, in the end, that was one of many elements in that where you're like, okay, you know, like having the runabout sitting outside the prison,
right?
Like them being able to receive a priority transmission from Dr. Bashir through a wormhole where there's no relay station anymore. It got destroyed in the first episode.
Is it a relay station or a relay station?
Don't actually tell you what Bashir's message is. They're simply like, oh, well, that other Bashir must be really bad.
Yeah, it couldn't
be. Bing, bang, you're like.
Well, is there more likely that there's a changeling on the Gamma Quadrant side of the wormhole that's going under Bashir's name? Or that they're, maybe we should not wait and kill the Bashir that we know right now in the new uniform at this point. They seem pretty quick to figure it out. I have to applaud them.
Anyway, but, you know, in the end, they only had two episodes. And the other funny one was noticing little things where they're like, okay, you guys are saving your money for that big, like all those ships you're going to be flying around.
Right.
For instance, the side panel windows are closed on the runabout, so they don't have to animate those stars.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
And like lots of moments where like Sisko talks about the Starfleet task force is almost here. And it's arrived, but you never see it.
Right.
Until, we do get to see some Romulan warbirds decloak.
Well, you see them sitting there. Anyway, yeah. I just thought that was interesting.
There's budget concerns, Patrick.
But in the end was kind of come back to what I was saying. It was just kind of interesting reminding yourself of exactly this question. That this wasn't a scripted series, that they had to make choices, and that they couldn't, you know, a third episode in this series would have been, or in this particular story would have been great.
Well, guys, why don't we kind of get into this? Is always kind of the thesis that we always want to address here. But does this justify itself as a two-part episode? Cam, what do you think?
Well, it's interesting because Ira Steven Baer actually, you know, he acknowledged like fans love this two-parter, but he thinks it would have been better as like a Way of the Warrior type two-hour episode.
Okay.
Or he said as a 90-minute episode. Like, he just thought...
They stretched that out just a little too much, or...?
He said part two was too fast-paced, and you had part one that felt slower-paced. Whereas, like, if it had been a solid, you know, two-hour block of a 90-minute episode, you would pace it more like a movie as opposed to two separate episodes.
I'll say this, though. It seems a little... Like, I love this episode, but it's definitely less epic than, say, Way of the Warrior, though. And so I don't know if it would quite lend itself to that format.
Yeah, I mean, I think it works as a two-parter for sure. I think the story is consistent throughout. It feels like it's building to something. We get it's carried by the Garak, essentially, character and his personal struggles and the claustrophobia and all that. And the drama of them being in the prison, I think it kind of, I don't know. What did you guys think of the ending with? I think the ending works conceptually, but with Changeling Bashir running towards the sun and then like kind of like.
Well. I had that Smash Mouth song like ringing through my head during that entire sequence.
Right.
Like, I did like the sequence where all of a sudden Bashir looks up and goes, oh, this is going wrong. And the thing flips, you know, the runabout flips backwards and it explodes.
Goes out like a firecracker.
Near the sun, which apparently isn't a problem, just only if it exploded in the sun.
Right. Was that not the best shot in the entire episode where, like, Changeling Bashir had, like, the dumbest look on his face? And, like, they had, like, a flashlight in his face to represent the sun? I'm just like, it's 90s television, guys.
But did this feel to you a little bit anticlimactic just because of the effects of the time?
Okay, well, I'll say this, though. Like, let's say there was like a big space battle or whatever.
Even a battle, but I just felt like it was a little bit clunky in terms of the filmmaking at that point.
Okay, yeah, it did.
Because I don't care if there's a battle, but, you know, I just think of like, you know, even an older episode, like, you remember the Doomsday Machine? with Kirk taking on the Doomsday Machine with the, with that ship that he has to ram into it. Like,
Constellation?
The Doomsday Machine.
Yeah. Yeah. No, no, the ship, was it the Constellation?
The Constellation.
Yeah, that he had to ram into it. And to me, there's more tension in that face-off versus, you know, Changeling Bashir running this the shuttle into the sun.
But Cam, they have to go to warp speed inside a solar system. They made a big deal out of that.
I mean, it just feels to me like that falls a little flat. Like, it just doesn't quite work as well as it should.
I agree.
I feel like I should be a little bit more edgier seat.
But I was thinking about that, and I think one of the issues is they were kind of hamstrung by the fact that I think by then they knew that they were going to have an all-out kind of big showdown for the season finale. So what can they really do here? I get what you're saying. It's more about kind of a filmmaking issue that they could have addressed it in a different way than like some big explosive sort of like battle sequence. But I agree with you. I think that's a totally valid criticism of the episode.
Mm-hmm. And the reason why I would also argue for having a third episode is it gives you a chance to actually give Odo something to do.
Right, yeah.
It lets you develop some ridiculous...
But like explore his raging sexuality.
So there's your
we
C
got
story.
Hints of,
and it lets you build a D story around Jake.
I was going to say Jake.
Where is Jake?
Yeah. And Molly O'Brien. She's getting older.
And Kira Yoshi was just born. Like, I needed more Kira Yoshi.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, okay.
So, anyway, they chose to do the family stuff with Zial, and that worked because it made sense with Dukat and helped them expose more about Dukat. But I kind of was like, what's poor old Jake doing? Like, has Jake been sent away? Or
Is Jake doing at this point?
To be fair, though, Sisko does not play a huge role in this two-parter.
He's not.
So. Sisko doesn't even have that much screen time, so I don't expect a lot from Jake. Because generally you're not going to use Jake unless Nog or Sisko are really there. And Nog's not present, and Sisko's in his office most of the time. There's a moment, though, where Avery Brooks walks out of his office where he looks so badass.
Oh, yeah. I know the moment you're talking about.
You can really tell, and, you know, just
he's
going...
He's just, like, on screen.
You can really feel how much more, like, battle-hardened Sisko is at this point in the series. Like, he just feels...
Yeah.
Like a tougher, wearier Sisko than we've seen, you know, like, because I'm right now, as I said, in season 3 of my rewatch, Sisko feels very different jumping to this point for me.
It's the haircut, man. I think that's a big
part
of it. It's
the body language, though. Like, Avery Brooks just...
He's been working out.
Yeah.
In the clink.
In the clink? He's like doing pull-ups.
He's a changed man.
he's got like a teardrop tattoo, like... at this point.
No, I totally agree. No, I know, and I know what you mean. Like, there's a hardness to him in this, and the sort of, you know, his conversation with Dukat, he's like, you're welcome to try.
Yeah, I feel like earlier Sisko would show a little more sort of being flustered or just like, you know, being aggravated. It's like, Dukat, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Whereas here, it's just like, I'll take you on anytime. Yeah. You know, it's very that just like... just willing to go mano a mano and not going to back down at any cost.
See, that was one of the things that I thought. I with the sort of time being of the essence, the actual conversation where they have, Dukat, what are you doing? And he declares what he's doing. And you're like, couldn't you have had... Like, that to me is a moment where you read out a message. Like, you don't actually have to have that extra, you know, 30 seconds even. Because, you know, I was just like, that. It just felt a bit clunky. Like, and first of all, I've forgotten that Dukat had a bird of prey at this point, which is hilarious.
Right.
But, no, it just was kind of like they're going out to confront. And he's like, nope, I'm going with them. Bye. And he's like, they're like, why? Why would you do that? And he's like, I'm allied with them.
I mean, this was very much setting up the takeover of Deep Space Nine the next season. So, I mean, I'm fine with that.
No, the same season.
Oh, is it the same season?
It's at the end.
Yeah, oh, that's
the,
right. Yeah, yeah, finale. Of course. Called Arms. Yeah,
yeah
the finale. Yeah,
and again,
for sure.
Again, the theme of return. So,
well, I mean, Deep Space Nine, it does represent home for all of these characters. And, you know, the fact that one episode mentions purgatory and the other Inferno is essentially hell. They're, you know, it's them going to purgatory and hell, but returning home ultimately. So, I mean, again, like, you got to give DS9 points for thematic titles.
Oh.
Like, they know what they're doing. Yeah.
Great title by this point. Absolutely. Yeah.
They only get more and more epic.
So, you know, how do you two feel about, like, this is a two-parter? Do you think it works as well as, you know, Patrick, you did Homefront and Paradise Lost with us, right?
Yeah, way better than that, for sure. Because they're you know, as a cohesive story, it totally works. You know, you really get some really great elements thrown at you, as we mentioned. There's this whole twist of the Bashir twist, which is just, you know, works internally in the episode. It doesn't
see the Bashir twist is actually the dance that Cam learned in the clink.
Those are some awkward dance lessons.
I'm now it's getting serious. Yeah. I think as a two-part episode, I think it's really solid. Like I said, some rushed elements in the second, the second part, but you know, that's life. And when does that not happen in Star Trek?
Yeah, I'm good with it. I mean, this seems like smaller on scale than an episode like, say, Way of the Warrior, but but it's also very grand in a way where like you get to the end of it and you're like, Wait a minute, Cardassia is in the Dominion now? Like, we're kind of in the home stretch of this is kind of changing the trajectory of the series. Like, it's going in a direction, we're leading up to the Dominion War here, and I think this is such... There's a few episodes where I just say, oh, it's just badass all the way through, and I think we've got so many strong character moments. And look, I think it really shows that Andy Robinson can totally... He could be kind of a lead character on, like, a series like Star Trek, and... I just love it. What a badass episode. Definitely two parts for me. I'm down with that.
And just the fact that we're seeing a lot of these DS9 two-parters, how much weight they carry. Like, there's a real sense of ramifications to these two-parters that wasn't the case with TNG, just because of the sense it was episodic. But with these DS9 ones, they feel heavy in a way. You know, it's not that they're not slogs to go through. They're fun. You know, they're exciting. They have character moments that you really latch onto. But when it's over, there's like that sort of that pause that you're just like, whew, like, where are we going next? Like, they actually feel like you're kind of, they make you want to just sit and think about what you've watched, you know, for the last 2 hours in a way that I don't know that any other Trek series really did. You'd see the odd one. I think there's like a Voyager one here or there that has, you know, like maybe Year of Hell. But for the most part, not really. Not at least not to the degree that Deep Space Nine touches.
I agree with that. DS9 more like DS Badass or something like that.
Totally.
Come on.
Why weren't you in their marketing department?
I know, like, hire me, guys.
Because you weren't in the clink.
I know.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Tyler, we're also on Facebook. Where are we?
Yeah, go to facebook.com/subspacepod. Like us there. Just search for us in this Facebook toolbar. We're putting all this exclusive content on, videos, commentary episodes that you can't get through our regular feed. We're having a lot of fun there, and we don't want anybody to miss out. We're also just going to be ramping up even more content as soon as Discovery premieres, so make sure you're following us so you don't miss out on anything there.
Groovy. And what are we doing next week?
Cam, can you believe it? I would hope not, since it's been we spent about last hour talking all about kind of the lead up to the Dominion War, but it's been 20 years since the kind of the Dominion War invasion arc, and so we're going to examine how that really changed storytelling in Star Trek. I'm talking about kind of a call to arms through Sacrifice of Angels, that kind of 7-episode arc there. You and I, we're going to sit down. We've got a special guest lined up for that. We're going to examine it hardcore. It's going to be fun. It's going to be insightful. It's going to be deep space badass.
Groovy. So you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vorta Sex Maniac Smith.
Oh, yeah. You can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTON. N as in never turn your back on a Breen.
And Patrick.
I'm at Rising Action. Not what you think.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.